You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme...
We're going to listen to him first. He launched this referendum project, which is a very risky thing. We want the UK to stay in the European Union. But as much as we say yes to an improvement in the Union, we can't agree to a dismantling.
French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius as Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron hops the channel to launch his charm offensive on Europe. But will it work? I'll be asking my guests Daniela Pellard and Quentin Peel. Also ahead, a game of two halves and now two criminal inquiries.
FIFA has taken a battering over the last two occasions, quite rightly. It now needs a totally different leadership, and therefore the most important thing for FIFA is that Mr. Blatter, after many years, steps down and someone else takes his place, someone who believes in transparency and honesty.
The chairman of England's Football Association makes his view clear earlier as FIFA falls foul of investigators on both sides of the Atlantic. But can Blatter survive? And should he? Plus, after it's confirmed that former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is standing down as Middle East envoy for the Quartet, we'll be discussing his legacy, which shouldn't take us too long. That's all coming up on Midori House right now on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellard, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Quentin Peel, associate fellow with the Europe Programme at Chatham House. Welcome both. Now, when David Cameron promised British voters a referendum on EU membership, it must have been at least partly in the hope of finally resolving an issue which has bedevilled British politics, and especially his Conservative Party, for decades. Until the vote, however, it will bedevil all of those things all the more. The Prime Minister has begun a short tour of Europe capitals in a bid to persuade his, for the moment, fellow EU leaders of the necessity of reform. Quentin, this is quite a weird one for the rest of Europe, because obviously they probably don't want the UK to leave, but they definitely don't want to bend too far to keep the UK in. How far is David Cameron able to push his luck?
I don't think necessarily very far. I was having my ear bent the other day by a senior German politician who said, look, I don't think we've ever known a situation where the British government was less worried about the geopolitical consequences of its own actions. Here is Europe facing Eurozone economic crisis, facing Putin and a crisis with Russia in the East, facing an immigration crisis in the Mediterranean resulting from Middle East conflict and African conflict. And there is Britain trying to have a totally self-indulgent little negotiation of its own. It was extraordinary. Now, that's a German reaction to it. But as you say, there is this tortured nature to the whole thing that actually nobody wants Britain to leave. So if David Cameron can be quite sensible about what he asks for, he'll get it. The trouble is, the people he wants to persuade in his referendum, actually most of them want to leave, so they don't want a sensible deal.
Daniela, is this a somewhat self-indulgent, self-regarding foible of an island nation refusing to look at the bigger picture?
Well, I would say so, but then I'm a supporter of the United Kingdom staying inside Europe. I mean, to an enormous extent, it's about perception. It's about the image that many members of our island nation have of a sovereign Britain, not under the yoke of European oppressors. And it's got much more to do, I would argue, with emotion than it has to do with fact. But then again, I mean, I am prejudiced.
Most politics does.
Yeah, true. But I have yet to see convincing arguments from the no camp that actually Britain would be better off in any way apart from sort of psychologically.
It is curious, isn't it? Because the Brits have always been regarded in Europe as the ones who were utterly pragmatic. It was all about pounds, shillings and pence. And actually, at the end of the day, we're having an extraordinarily emotional debate.
I mean, speaking as an outsider to Britain and obviously to Europe as well, the vague thought has always struck me, looking at the long game, that, that somewhere deep buried in the British race memory is this idea that whenever somebody in the continent comes up with some grand scheme for unifying Europe, the British people, oh, not again. Because this all ends with us waist deep in mud in Flanders by Christmas. But there is a different attitude I have noticed in Britain. There is the rest of Europe. A lot of Europe likes the EU. Eastern Europe especially adores the EU and regards it as something to be aspired to, whereas the British either resent it, ignore it, don't quite understand it, but they've never liked it.
I think you're absolutely right about, you know, the great continental visions, whether it was Napoleon's vision or Hitler's vision. Clearly those two were
The precedents are not happy, no.
But having said that, the Brits' problem was, after the Second World War, actually, Winston Churchill went out there and said, European Union, great idea, but of course, what we mean is France and Germany should get together, and we'll still have our empire. Well, the empire crumbled pretty quickly, and nonetheless, the Brits kept saying, no, we don't need it, they'll do their thing. In the end, when we joined way along the line in 1973, we joined because actually we'd lost the economic debate. Europe was doing much better than we were. And so rather grumpily, we went in and promptly got hit by a mega economic crisis. So it's been actually rather negative in the whole British psyche ever since.
It also strikes me, though, Daniela, that, and again, this may be my somewhat sceptical outsider's perspective, that shorn of absolutely all the other blather that is surrounding this argument and will surround this argument, this is for Britain right now. This is basically about immigration, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, returning to your earlier point, I don't think it's just self-indulgent in the as regards the rest of Europe, but also self-indulgent as regards British politics. I mean, the next year or 2 years, all the oxygen of government is going to be sucked out by the referendum, and that's going to be our focus. And I really don't believe that migrants from within the European Union claiming benefits is the greatest danger to our country economically, socially, or in any other way. I mean, this is about a self-indulgent battle within the Conservative Party, one that we've seen played out over and over again. And as I said, a kind of emotional battle that we're worried about migrants. We're worried about migrants, and we're very far away from actually looking at it in a reasonable way and seeing that migration is an issue that's not going to disappear. And we need to be part of Europe to deal with it. Even if we left the EU, we'd still have a land border with the EU country, Ireland. I mean, we can't cut ourselves off from it in any way.
Let me, though, just try and be a little bit against the focus of our debate, because clearly the European Union is not an ideal world. You've got 28 countries, a very bureaucratic system. It's anything, any organisation with that many countries involved is incredibly difficult to make work. It takes forever to reach decisions, and most decisions are clumsy compromises at the end of the day. So it isn't a comfortable solution, but it's a bit like what Winston Churchill said about democracy, you know. It's not nice, but it's the best thing we've got.
The worst possible way to run things apart from all the others. I just want to ask you that question as well, Quentin, about immigration. Do you think that basically that is what this is going to boil down to? And if David Cameron can come back with some sort of compromise that restricts freedom of movement into the United Kingdom to some extent, he can probably sell that to the British people.
I don't think he's going to succeed. I think that's a real risk, because if he tries to get a solution that is fundamentally discriminatory, that's to say, an EU immigrant to Britain cannot claim social security when he's paying his social security, paying his taxes, working in a job, then to the same degree that a Brit can, that is absolutely contrary to the treaties, and none of the East European countries, let alone the Germans, will go along with it. So he's actually got to be very careful what he asks for. And I don't think, when he says, and this is the rhetoric, I want to change the basis of British membership, the terms of British membership in Europe, Fiddling around with immigration is not changing the terms of British membership. It's pandering to a certain part of the electorate.
Well, we shall doubtless return to this one ad infinitum over the next 2 years or so. That's worth staying alive for. But while making the British happy, Europeans will not be easy. David Cameron can reflect that he at least has an easier task than the one lately attempted by one of his predecessors. Tony Blair has spent the last 8 years as Middle East envoy for the Quartet. That's the UN, EU, US and Russia, attempting to encourage economic growth, etc. in the region. As he steps down, he can probably argue that Oman is pretty quiet. But Daniela, are there any other positive accomplishments on his watch?
Well, I would like to be fair to Tony Blair, even though as outlandish as that sounds. I mean, his remit was always to focus on economic...
He's been clobbered with a lot of unfair sort of headlines this week, saying your peace envoy steps down, which was never his job.
I don't think he was... he may have delusions of grandeur, but I don't think even he really believed that he could descend on the Middle East and bring peace to Israel and Palestine.
I think he might have believed that a little bit.
Maybe a little bit. But in terms of economic achievements, I mean, he has had some standout... some standout issues. He, I think it was in 2010 or 11, he managed to convince the Israelis to give a Palestinian telecom company, Wataniya, bandwidth? What do mobile phones use?
That sounds like the sort of thing mobile phones use.
Frequencies, that's it. Frequencies, which the Israelis had said that would endanger their security. And that was quite a major advance. I think Wataniya now nearly has a quarter of the market. And he also managed to sort out some issues with the oil fields off the coast of Gaza. This is all also, of course, slightly hampered by allegations that he had some interests in the parent companies that were involved in these deals as well. In terms of the Palestinian economy, there have been some improvements and there's been dismantling of checkpoints and some economic growth, although how much you can attribute to Tony Blair is, well, I would say, if not, I would be charitable to say unclear. But really, it's not about economic growth. It's about the occupation and it's about political viability of Palestine as a state. And Blair made absolutely no impact on that whatsoever.
We shall return to the occupation later in this programme. Quentin, the reaction of the British press to him standing down has been fairly uniformly cynical. Is that fair? How much of it is that just because he has become this bizarre folk demon almost in Britain now? I mean, the right wing in Britain hate him because he was a Labour Prime Minister, and an awful lot of the left have never forgiven him for winning three elections.
I think you put that nicely. The left have never forgiven him for going to war in Iraq.
That's
what it's all about. And he's a tragic figure, really, because here's a deeply moral person who was actually went to war in Iraq because he was absolutely convinced by earlier experiences in Sierra Leone and in Kosovo that humanitarian intervention works. He was utterly wrong. In the case of Iraq, certainly, and probably in the case of Kosovo too. But it's a tragic case, and I think he's gone on believing that there was a sort of bit of a moral crusade he had to do out there, and his real success has been zero.
He does rather fancy the call from the Nobel Peace Committee at some point, doesn't he? I do think that was buzzing in his head a bit. I mean, he's not an old man. What should he do now that there's a job going at FIFA? We'll get to that shortly. There's a job going at the Labour Party, come to that. I mean, what do you do with someone like Tony Blair at this point?
Gosh, well, you know, any positions at the EU?
there are lots of organisations dotted around for former heads of government and heads of state. They're all rather sad, you know. They're all people who feel, I was kicked out before my time, I should have had the chance to do a bit more. It's the ultimate job in any individual country. And when you're thrust out of it before you're ready for it, you feel pretty disgruntled.
At least he doesn't need to worry about having to work again.
Well, there is that as well.
Mortgages are being paid.
But just a final thought on this one, Daniela, before we take a short break. Could anybody have actually done any better in that job? I mean, he did seem like a slightly strange choice of Middle Eastern envoy, given the whole Iraq thing, which did not endear him, I think it's fair to say, to most of the Arab world.
Well, to be fair, Tony Blair, as a British Prime Minister, was always very, very engaged on Israel-Palestine consistently throughout his time. And I believe that he thought he could make a difference. He could he could make a change. But could a quarter envoy make a difference? I think the probably the figure with most influence in that region would be the Secretary of State of the United States.
Okay, well, we will look upon his successor's works with interest. We don't know yet who his successor will be.
They might not bother.
Well, they might not bother. Again, Sepp Blatter could be looking for work shortly. George Galloway, unfortunately, is running for Mayor of London, so he's out. We will take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellid and Quentin Peel. Coming up next, we will be looking at the FIFA circus and a reminder of what Tony Blair was up against.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, The Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, The Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are my guests Daniela Pellid and Quentin Peel. Now, a day after seven of FIFA's top officials, among others, were arrested in Zurich, the beleaguered organisation's president, Sepp Blatter, spoke earlier today and gave it the full Captain Renault. Shocked, I tell you, at suggestions of corruption in FIFA, almost as if such allegations and suspicions have not been a constant of his interminable rule of world football, which he still hopes to extend to a fifth term tomorrow. Quentin, Michel Platini, UEFA's president, has urged him to go, suggest that UEFA could even boycott the next World Cup. Sponsors are wobbling. Even if Blatter manages to get the numbers together tomorrow, is he still viable, really?
Well, on one hand, you'd say all logic dictates that he's completely damaged goods.
But how many times have we been able to say that of Sepp Blatter?
Indeed, he's just hangs on like a bad penny. He's always there. And I have a horrible feeling that the world of football know what they've got and don't actually dislike it. I mean, can you imagine the logical consequence of a real clean-up now is that actually the World Cup won't be held in Russia and then it won't be held in Qatar, and think of all the money that's been poured into those places already. So a huge backlash. Can they afford to actually do the decent thing?
Well, on the subject of all the money, Daniela, one of the interesting developments that has occurred in the last 24 hours is some mutterings from sponsors. I'm not at all obviously privy to the contractual details of their agreements with FIFA. But it does seem weird that companies like Visa and others are muttering about reviewing their agreements with FIFA over this. The deaths of at least 1,000 migrant workers in Qatar, not so much for some reason.
Is that surprising? Really?
It should be surprising, shouldn't it?
It should be surprising. It isn't surprising. I think they're standing back waiting to see where and how the axe falls on this. I know nothing about football, but to me it would seem astonishing if Sepp Blatter managed to managed to survive this. And if he survived this and the sponsorship and businesses carried on and business as usual, if that's what happens in international sport, then perhaps I should start paying more attention.
Well, it strikes me, and this is my pet theory, that sports organisations, especially international ones, or in fact any sort of sports organisation, is more prone to this kind of thing, more prone to corruption because, or more prone to getting away with it, because they know they can rely on the consumers not to walk away, more than the producers of most entertainment and most goods. Because I know, as a tragic fan of one particular team in one particular sport, that it would need to go a long way before I stopped paying attention. And I think that's true of sports fans. Football fans all over the world will be saying this is appalling and this is dreadful. They'll all watch the World Cup if it's held in Russia or Qatar or hell, won't they?
I'm trying to think what team it is that's quite bad enough to earn your devotion, Andrew.
Careful
having said
now.
Which. No, I think it's the financial model, isn't it? It's this model of almost unlimited sponsorship funds because of television, because of the television rights and everything else, which is somehow so distanced from the end product, so that there's always money that you can basically simply skim off, because the end product, the fan, who's very devoted, as you say, even when their teams lose interminably all their motor cars in Formula One or whatever it is, they hang on in there, and they've never seen the money one way or the other. They're just actually dummies who are watching the advertising.
Daniela, as a non-sports fan, do they strike you as slightly less discriminating consumers than consumers of most things?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I really wouldn't, because it's very easy to say, well, the game is beautiful, but it's the system that's at fault. FIFA, you know, we can call for FIFA to be reformed, for some heads to roll, and the the sports to carry on as before. I do find it hard to understand why people should be so devoted to this, and people should be can ignore these enormous salaries paid to football players, and sort of carry on with this sort of semi fantasy of sport. But I wouldn't say that they were sort of mugged into it.
But sport answers our sort of need for fairy tales and our need for tribal identification.
Sport without the war without the shooting, Orwell called it.
Yeah, probably.
I thought we had the European Union for that.
But on that subject, though, Quentin, just a final thought on this before we do crack on with peace in the Middle East in the few minutes we have left. There will end up being some sort of wider, actual, serious, real-world diplomatic political consequence to this, right? There's Vladimir Putin already suggesting that this whole thing is a stunt by the United States in order to seize the World Cup from Russia.
On the one hand, I think it is slightly remarkable that it has to be the United States that actually really come up with apparent evidence on this, rather than a serious football-playing nation. Hey, where were the Brits or the French or the Germans? Having said which, I don't have much doubt in my own mind that this is a pretty ghastly can of worms and that Mr. Putin's people were happy to play in it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will take a look at a current reminder of what Tony Blair was struggling with. Recently re-elected Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has signalled that he wants to begin talks with his Palestinian counterparts about Israel's West Bank settlements, but they may not be the kind of talks that the Palestinians would probably prefer. Daniela, what is his big idea?
Well, he wants to start talking about setting the boundaries of the settlement blocks in the West Bank, which, in the event of any peace deal, most sides agree will stay part of Israel sovereign. The only problem is that this is completely absent any kind of peace deal, so it's slightly setting the cup for the horse. The Palestinians, of course, have said, well, actually, hold on a sec, the settlements are illegal under international law, so how is this going to help? All it is from Netanyahu is a sleight of hand to try and give the illusion that there is some sort of peace process ongoing, where there is absolutely nothing, not a ghost of it.
Is that what's going on here, Quentin? Because it looks so transparently like Israel saying, well, we're willing to talk. And then when the Palestinians go on those terms, are you kidding? The Israelis can say, well, we offered and the Palestinians wouldn't talk to us.
It certainly looks pretty cynical. I think that Netanyahu's calculation is that the Europeans, to whom he appears to have made the offer in the person of Federica Mogherini, are so desperate that there should be some sign of a diplomatic process that they will actually latch on to almost anything. And indeed, Ms. Mogherini came out and said just now that she thinks there is the chance of getting a democratic process going again. I think actually it's also, though, a sign of weakness, even if it's a sign of cleverness on the part of Netanyahu. I think he is under quite a lot of pressure because of the number of countries that have started recognizing the Palestinian state, because of the very real moves, I think, in Europe to actually refuse to buy goods from settlements and so on. There's pressure growing there, and I think this is also a diversionary tactic.
Does Netanyahu think Israel has a PR problem there, or is this not the kind of thing that keeps Netanyahu awake at night?
Not only does Netanyahu think that Israel has a PR problem, but almost every single Israeli, from the right to the left, think that Israel has a PR problem. It's a national obsession. They even have a word for it, hasbara, which means explaining. They feel that the world would understand the plight Israel finds itself in if only people explained it better, the spokesman spoke better English, the visuals coming from Israel were more attractive. This is not quite hasbara, but certainly it's an attempt by Netanyahu to give the impression of some sort of action. And don't forget, he's already been condemned roundly by other members of his cabinet, even more right-wing than he is. By standards of the current Israeli government, Netanyahu is quite a centrist.
But, Quentin, does this leave the Palestinian leadership, should they want to participate in these talks, which at the moment seems unlikely, is it actually politically possible for them? They've already said time and again, Mahmoud Abbas has said it, that he will only talk if there's a freeze on settlement building. He can't climb down from that in front of his own constituents, can he?
I wouldn't have thought he could. I would have thought it puts him in a very difficult position, which is why there's been a very clear and instant response, as far as one can see, to saying this is not a runner. There's always been the fundamental issue. We start from, at least in principle, the basis of pre-1967 boundaries. That may sound fantastical to people outside saying, hey, hang on, that's a very long time ago. It just doesn't work. But it is a part of the Holy Writ, I think, for the Palestinians, that you begin with some sort of level playing field. And the whole point of this Netanyahu proposal is you certainly aren't beginning from a level playing field.
Well, the Palestinians so far are certainly not buying it. Saeb Erekat, who's the chief Palestinian negotiator, has called it a request to continue illegal settlement construction with Palestinian consent. And Hanan Ashwari of the PLO's executive committee called it a disingenuous and manipulative exercise of political and legal deception. Are either of those two people wrong?
Well, that's a strangely worded question.
I do my best.
It's completely pointless. You know, the settlement blocks, I mean, in the very and extremely and highly unlikely of any two-state solution agreement, there will be settlement blocks that are a part of Israel. But a much more pressing problem even are the settlements which are even illegal under Israeli law, which the Israeli government has done very, very little to stop their expansion or to even dismantle them. I mean, if Netanyahu wanted to show willing for some sort of peace process, he could take action on that, and that would win him an awful lot more support in the international community and reciprocally on the Palestinian side. The era of negotiations is pretty much over. It's about unilateralism now, and I think Quentin's quite right. I think the Palestinian unilateral moves in international institutions and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign are going to have much more of an impact on the direction the two countries take than any amount of bilateral talks.
We will have to leave it there for this evening. Daniela Peled and Quentin Peel, thank you both very much for joining me here on Midori House. That is all for today's episode of the programme. It was produced by Alice Block, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jolene Goffin. Studio manager today was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, you can listen to Josh Fennett with Monocle's international playlist. 1900 Hours, The Urbanist follows. 2200 Hours, I'm back with with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. I'm also back with this show at 1800 tomorrow, London time. That's Midori House, 1800 Friday. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.